CataractCoach.com podcast episode number 43 with Morgan Micheletti, a talented young surgeon helping to advance our field. Our podcast is sponsored by Harrow Incorporated. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast today with a special guest, a young ophthalmologist, J. Morgan Micheletti. You first heard about him from all the amazing, complicated cases he's posting on social media and presenting at the meetings. I've seen countless articles from him. And most of all, I loved how he took the idea that we had of a twist-and-out IOL exchange, the X-Spinal Lens, and brought it to the next level, made it even easier. So clearly, he's got some amazing ways of thinking. And I want to touch base with him and get, you know, a know-how about what is the future for a young ophthalmologist. I'm solidly mid-career. He's beginning of the career. So Morgan, welcome. I'm so happy to have you here.
Uday, thank you so much for having me. It feels full circle almost to be on your show and be anything to do with Cataract Coach, having, you know, just watched it coming up and training. And I remember saying, oh, I got this complex case today. What should I do? I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go look it up on Cataract Coach and let me do a little research. And then I'd be able to impress my attending sometimes, like, well, where'd you learn that? And I'd be like, well, cataractcoach.com.
Yeah. Too funny. Well, as you know, I mean, we learn by making these videos. You make a lot of amazing videos and you really learn by the process, because you can go back and evaluate your cases and say, you know what? I should have done this differently.
Absolutely. Yeah. I absolutely learn more when I'm going back and narrating my cases. As I'm narrating them, I'm like, I wish I would have done, you know, I could have done this or I could have done that. And so it is something that's the entire process. You're hoping to spread and share some complex cases and potentially, you know, a few pearls here and there, but really, I think I probably get more out of my own videos than probably anyone else.
Right. No, for sure. And it's a good way of kind of evaluating it. Even like you said, watching other people's videos, you know, the twist and out method for lens exchange. Well, I first learned from Jack Chapman, and then Jack Chapman, me, and then all Rahul Pundit from Houston also published a paper about how to do this technique. So it essentially means you're grabbing the edge of the optic and you rotate in the eye and you use a spatula with the other hand to help roll the lens and to protect the endothelium.
Right.
But you saw that and you said, well, that's a great idea. But you took it one step further. Tell us more.
Yeah. So it just by happenstance, I normally make two pairs of TCs whenever I'm performing most IOL exchanges. Depends on how far out it is. If it's recent, I don't always need to do that. But if I'm having to dissect the lens away from the capsule, you know, 360 degrees and it's more than 6 months, then I'll make two pairs of TCs. And it just so happened that I was asking for a spatula and there wasn't one in that tray. And so all they were looking for, I was like, just give me something else. And then I started, you know, I looked at it and I go, I'm going to connect these two. And I had kind of thought about it the night before on just some eye models, but I was like, you know, I really think I can do this. So I'm going to connect these two pairs of TCs and use that as the kind of traction in order to rotate the IOL against, because it is, for me, it's always been, you know, you don't have to do this huge full twist, but it is a big twist when you do it one-handed as you're holding another spatula. Right. And what I liked about it is I was then able to kind of use two hands together, almost like you would use an IA. Like if you're twizzling an IA, sometimes you can spin it faster if you hold it at the back, you know, similar kind of idea. And it just came out and I was like, that worked pretty easily. And so being honest, I use them both. There's sometimes when I just grab a spatula and twist it out. And sometimes I do the modified technique and sometimes I bisect it and cut it out. Just, you know, I think the important thing is just having a lot of tools at your disposal and just being like, all right, what is this case? What's going to be the easiest or the simplest for this particular case? But yeah, I mean, kudos to you guys for writing that up. I mean, definitely one of those things that I thought was just such a slick technique. The other technique that, and I haven't gotten a ton of experience with it for an IOL exchange is, and Bill Wiley had talked a lot about this.
Uninjected.
The reverse insertion. It's so cool. Yeah. It's so slick. And initially he described it as, I think it was with an ICL forcept and I think it was.
Yeah, the Japanese surgery credits is Fukuoka.
Yes, exactly.
You grab with a very, very long forceps, grab it through a cartridge. Yes. And then you can just pull it through the cartridge. An amazing thing.
Exactly. It's beautiful. And I think he's a retina surgeon actually in Japan who first kind of, at least the videos that he published were vitrectomy based videos with an exchange. Beautiful, beautiful videos. And the first time I saw it was like I said, with Bill Wiley, but Really cool. Something that, you know, I really want to try to get my hands on some of the, because you do need some unique instruments to do that. You need a forcep that's long enough to reach down the cartridge and grasp it. But I think what's cool about some of the other techniques is you don't really need any extra tools to do twist and out. You know, for the most part, it's what you have there.
Point well, one, part two. Of the issue for me was, you know, I for 22 years, I taught residents at a big UCLA teaching hospital where I was chief ophthalmology. And in that hospital, we were not allowed to bring in any extra instruments. So I had like, I said, okay, you know, we have a tough case. Let me bring in my MST tray. No outside instruments are allowed. So like, okay, how am I going to do this? Like, okay, well, I can use a straight tying forcep, but I could use a spatula. And you kind of make do. Even sometimes we wouldn't have the appropriate eye instrumentation for bimanual. It's like, okay, you know what I can do? I can make an AC maintainer out of like an IV cannula.
Right.
So give me the 23 or 25 gauge IV cannula, the plastic cannula that I get it from the anesthesiologist. Let me just modify that. So you kind of learn to MacGyver things. And absolutely. I do like your idea of like have as many kind of techniques in your mindset and tools in your tool set.
Yeah, I think it's the same for nuclear disassembly. I mean, people ask me, I mean, I have my own go-to technique. I'm a horizontal chopper, but I think being able to do everything is really important because there's going to be a case where, you know, it's real dense, leathery posteriorly, and mm-hmm. you can't quite get that good chop, and you got to do a little different technique. And so I think just for young surgeons watching, just learn it all and be good at it all, proficient at it all. I think that's really the key.
I think so too. I think, you know, emulate your mentors as you're going along, learn as much as you can, as many techniques as you can. And then kind of refine it and decide what you like as your fastball. But even me, I'm a chop surgeon too. Usually a vertical chop, combo chop, whatever chop. Mm-hmm. But there's some cases like I did one this week. Shallow AC, dense rock, highly hyperopic patient. I was like, you know what? If I make a nice wide groove in a stop and chop, then each nuclear half is not going to be 50%. It's going to be like 40%. And it'll give me a lot more maneuverability. And I just did that. Right. So I hadn't done stop and chop in probably the prior 100 cases.
But you had it there. You had it there in your tool belt, ready to go.
Right. You know? Right. And then coming up first week in January, I've got an MSICS case. A patient a patient who doesn't believe in doctors. 80-something years old, she says she's never seen a doctor in her life. You believe in faith-based medicine or something. Bless her. But it was an absolutely dense rock. And she's got Fuchs. And her corneal bookimetry is 610. And her endothelial cell count's 880. I'm like, you're getting M6.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good choice there. I think so. You know, it's one of those things. Not only having all these different techniques that you can rely on, but I think the important thing, and you've done this, this is something that I like to do just because it just keeps me inquisitive and keeps me engaged, is asking yourself why you're doing every single step along the way. And I think that's really where we can continue to drive innovation, come up with new techniques. Why am I doing it this way? Why am I chopping this way? Why am I using my, you know, INA this way? Can I try it this way? Can I do it this way? You know, I think there's a lot that can come with that. I mean, a lot of people are doing hydro insertions now instead of using Provisc. They're, you know, just using irrigation through the side port and you helping, you know, either having a tech or if it's a auto cartridge like the Autonomy, you know, then you can do an insertion without Provis, save all that ion, you know, all that OVD removal at the end of the case and potentially prevent some pressure spikes. So there's lots of things that can constantly, you know, even though there's so much innovation, there's still so many little tiny things that we can change that can help either our efficiency or improve patient outcomes, or, you know, reduce drops if their pressure's 30 or something like that. You know, hopefully we can prevent that pressure spike, you know? So I think that's another really just something to keep in the back of everyone's mind is let's ask why. Why are we doing this?
Yeah, that's great. Question everything. You know what? When I was a resident, I did not have the courage to question. When I saw my chairman of the department who never did FACO, he only did the extra caps. Back when residents were all doing FACO, only FACO. You only had extra caps. And when I saw those corneal scleral scissors to the left and to the right, I cringed, but I didn't have the guts to say anything. But I did question. I was like, yeah, there's got to be a better way. And that's about the time, the year 2000-ish, now MSICS is being developed. Like, yeah, they questioned it too, but they had more cards than me.
Right. And it was you know, it was partly how I was watching some videos by Sergio Canabrava, and I had an IOL exchange patient who had a dislocated lens, and really our standard of care was just to go ahead and explant it and then do a Yamani or so, you know, sutured, you know, Gore-Tex fixated Acrios or MX60 or whatever. And that it's, you know, same thing. I kind of question, it's like, well, can we, you know, rescue that lens? And there's lots of techniques for that now, right? Sure. I mean, and there has been for a while with the belt loop technique or double flange or just lassoing with Gore-Tex. But the punch thing was kind of fun. It was just something a little different. And it was right after COVID. And I remember I had this case and I was really thinking about it. I was like, I really like Sergio's punch, but it was an extra ocular punch. And my kids were doing, I can't remember what project they're doing. It was COVID. You know, we were trying to, it was right after COVID. This was like early 2021. And they were home for something. It was early after school. They had some school project. And my son was had a handheld hole punch and was doing it in this like container, because we were trying to keep all the, you know, hanging chads, if you will, kind of consolidated, whatever the punched out pieces are. And I was like, well, maybe we can actually miniaturize a punch and actually use it inside the eye. And you know, turns out we were able to do that, which is kind of
for those who don't know, the Micheletti punch is actually, it's ingenious. It's basically a small little tiny hole punch that'll go through your phaco incision, and you can make a hole at the haptic optic junction of a single piece acrylic lens. Then through that hole, now you can put a proline and make a flange, or you can put a Gore-Tex and you can suture whatever you want to do. But now you've got a way of fixating that lens without just kind of lassoing a haptic, which is not that secure. So I think it's brilliant.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's something that I utilize a lot of these different techniques. So for single piece lenses,
should I thank you or your son? You're 6 years
old. Probably my son. Yeah, I mean, my son and Sergio, and you know, I mean, I for all of these things, it's standing on the shoulders of giants. I mean, really, it's you know, it's always yeah. I mean, I've been very fortunate to be in the position I'm in, and you know, just hopefully help take the next step on some things. But you know, for me, when I look at a dislocated lens, for the most part, if it's a single piece lens, I think a belt loop is perfectly reasonable in my hands. If it's a toric or a multifocal, I feel a little more confident in my centration and placement on axis.
Now, how are you ensuring though that you don't get proline flanges eroding through the conge, extruding? How do you ensure this? Because that's ended up being a problem. I've seen many more patients in the last few years now who've had a belt loop of some kind of 6-0 or 5-0 proline, and they left these blue bulbs under the conge, which are now poking out of the conge.
Yeah. No, it's something that you absolutely have to pay very close attention to. And you can't just bury it under the conge and have this big blue nub sitting there, because it will erode. And so the key is really, you want to make sure that it's snug, that there's not extra redundancy in the eye, because that will eventually erode out. The other thing is you want to make sure that it's tucked under not just conge, but also tenons. So well covered by both conge and tenons, and you don't need a huge flange. Right. So you really don't. It doesn't have to be that big. You want it enough that it's going to wedge in there and prevent intrusion into, you know, through the sclera. But you don't want this massive area of surface area that can serve as, you know, an area for erosion. And so knock on wood, none of my flanges to date have eroded, but it's certainly something that I look at. I mean, every single patient of the, you know, when I see them post-op now, many of them are 2 years out. It's absolutely something I make sure we check out. And if it's my optometrist seeing these patients, hey, if it's a flange patient, you make sure you check each one of those flanges. But it is something that has a learning curve. And the first time I did it, you know, I used 5-0 proline. It was a much bigger flange than I would do now. Fortunately, that patient.
Now you're doing 6-0.
Now I'm doing 6-0, smaller flanges. Yeah. And what I've been doing most recently is actually turning the punch and making the punch in plane with the optic.
Oh, interesting.
So in plane through the haptics. So really now you're creating, it's more like a three-piece lens where it's in plane, because I noticed that I was getting a decent amount of tilt even going through the haptic optic junction. But now in plane, it's more like a three-piece, like your traditional three-piece lens, because everything's in plane. And in the bag, this I would only use this for lenses that are in the capsular bag. I don't like the idea of free haptics, you know, going everywhere, possible UGG syndrome and things like that. But if they're enclosed in the bag and it's, you know, contracted down to 9 to 10 millimeters, and you have that holding the haptics in and you're punching through and that the suture is going outwards, then it's very stable. I mean, it really is very stable.
No, so, no, for sure. One of the things I've also switched to is just ensuring that the pass, the needle pass through the sclera is not perpendicular to the surface of the sclera. It has a tunnel length. And I try to get the flanges pushed into and wedged into the scleral tunnel. So ideally under conj, under tenons, but also within that scleral
wedged in there.
Wall. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the other thing. When I first started, because I was using a 5.0, I was using a 27 gauge needle. Now I'm using a 30 gauge TSK. You know, a lot of us have, we've gone smaller and smaller and less invasive, which is great. You know, it's funny when I think back to even coming up with the IOL punch. And I was fortunate that there was a manufacturer, Diametrics, nearby and in Houston that I was able to work with. Cause you know, I didn't know anyone. I mean, I didn't know anyone. And I mean, I remember sending out of the blue. I'd never talked with Ike Ahmed in my life, but I followed him on Instagram and I sent him a message and my whole design for the punch. And, he responded with, "Call me, bro," and gave me his cell. And I'll never forget. I was snowboarding. And I like froze and I was like, "Oh my gosh, I gotta call Ike." Like I called him, was like, "Hi." And he's like, "Hey, who's this?" And I'm like, "Hey, this is Morgan. I messaged you about the punch." He goes, "Oh, it's a cool idea. Tell me about it. Walk me through it." And there were some things that he questioned me on. He's like, "So what do you do with this?" And I was like, "I don't know." And he's like, "What do you mean you don't know? You got to think about that." And so it was just this really amazing mentorship thing that kind of started there. And, it's been, you know, I'm so thankful for all that initial help. I mean, I didn't even know what a KOL was. I had no
opinion leader, because a lot of the audience don't know either. KOL is key opinion leader.
No idea. So I messaged someone like, "Oh, I just had like an incredible conversation with Ike. I couldn't believe it. He thought it was a cool idea." And they responded back, "Oh, that's awesome. He's a KOL." And I remember I was with my friend who's a dentist, and I go, "What's a KOL?" And we spent the I was like, "I have no idea." You know, ChatGPT wasn't around to ask. I couldn't just, you know, "Hey, ChatGPT, what's up?"
And now look, what's happened. You become a key opinion leader. You're a KOL. So how did this happen? You're a young guy. You're 5 years after residency, five and a half years post-residency.
Yep.
You're like me. You're scrappy. You're self-taught, so no fellowship needed. I like that.
That's right. Hey, yeah, no, I mean, it was, again, it's just, it was a string of luck. I mean, my mentor... at our practice, our senior partner, Mike Kaplan, was a member of ACOS, and he kind of voluntold me to do this ACOS Cedars Aspen mentorship.
He voluntold me?
I was voluntold. I was voluntold. So I was like, okay, fine. So it's like, you know, I guess I get to go to Deer Valley. That's cool. But had to go up a couple of days early. And so I sit down and I knew nobody at that time. And so I sit down and it's Netta Shammy. And on my other side is Vance Thompson and, you know, Jim Katz and Leo Otero's in the back. And I'm surrounded by these incredible young ophthalmologists who I actually have heard of because of social media. So Dr. Glaucom Flecken was in that original Cedars Aspen mentorship class. So Will Flannery and Brian Schaefer and Brett Mueller, Arjun Hira. I mean, all these big names that you hear now, you know, and I was surrounded by all these people. And that was really... For me, that was the launch pad. And I latched on to a lot of them and they're my, you know, they're very close friends. That's where I met Christos, who's been an incredible mentor to me, almost like a brother. Hades.
We had him, we had him on the podcast a while ago too.
Yes, I know. I watched it. I love Christos. And that whole group, I mean, that core group, that whole experience. I mean, that's what really I felt like brought me into the fold, because it made me realize I was missing something. I loved my practice. I loved being head down in my practice. I was a PI and working on clinical trials and kind of just behind the scenes, just, you know, crunching away. But I really missed the, you know, feeling that you're as part of a larger group of people that are really working to advance the field.
You're contributing to the future of ophthalmology.
Contributing to the future. Absolutely. Okay. And I realized like, these are the people that I, these are like my people. And I started getting involved and more involved. And then just as luck would have it, I became involved in more studies and started to getting, I was fortunate enough to work in the background on some really cool projects and to get to go to other countries and try things before anyone else. And, you know, just really cool stuff, because what's fun about that, and I know you've done a lot of that with a lot of different clinical trials. You implanted some of the first new accommodating lenses and things that as well. But it's fun. And I think that's been some of the most fulfilling stuff I've done, because it was almost like, I mean, it's almost as Apollo 13 as we're going to get as ophthalmologists. You're there, you're implanting lenses, you've got the engineers, or you're implanting or using some new device. You got all the engineers there from the company.
Right.
And you're doing something, you're like, hey, this isn't quite working. You know, and everyone's on the spot, and it's like, all right, failure is not an option, people. Let's figure this out. and it's really fun.
Out of respect to the engineers, I mean, the engineers behind essentially everything we do in ophthalmology, these guys are geniuses.
It's incredible. I mean, and they're so on it, and they have an answer for everything so quickly. You know, and they're like, all right, we'll try this, and they were so respectful of your skill as a surgeon, right? They're like, can you do this? And you're like, I don't know if I can, but we'll give it a try. And it's just this, it's this beautiful back and forth. And at the end, you hope that you create something that then other surgeons and other people are going to be able to use and benefit from. And it's been one of the more fulfilling experiences that I've had.
Absolutely. It's a really neat process. I, like you, started doing a lot of the KOL stuff and traveling and speaking internationally young, like 32, 33. And a mistake I made, which to this day I still regret, was that early on, I was not good at work-life balance, family-work balance. And I think one of the funny stories I've told before on Cataract Coach is that, you know, one time I was about your age, 35, 36, and I get a letter in the mail from, back then they used the postage, the U.S. mail service. It's something foreign to you, I know, but they said, congratulations for our hotel chain. You've achieved diamond status because you stayed in our hotel 66 times last year. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so stupid.
Yeah.
So I had a hard time figuring out that balance. Then I went the opposite way, and I did like 8 years of like zero meetings, zero. The only traveling I did was vacations with family.
Yeah.
And now obviously it's an empty nest, but it's easier.
It was a struggle for me. I mean, honestly, when I first got started, and really getting involved, I wanted to go to every meeting. I wanted to hang out with all these amazing people that helped drive and fuel my passion. And it really was a struggle. And it's something that took me a good 18 months to really figure out. And I finally have figured it out. And now I'm busy, but I'm balanced. And it took a long time to get here. And it's still a give and take. But at the end of the day, you know, it's absolutely family first. I love there's a great analogy where it talks about, you know, life is juggling all these different balls, right? And there's one that's glass, and that if you drop, it's going to shatter. And that's your family,
right? It's gonna bounce back.
You can drop that ball and pick it right back up anytime, right? But you can never let that glass ball drop. And you know, when you learn that and realize that, and even when you do, and you may realize that from the very beginning, but it still takes time to figure out, especially, I mean, trying to balance social media when I was first getting started with social media, and then, you know, clinical trials, and then speaking and being involved in meetings and organizations, and then still being part of a busy practice. And, you know, having three kids running around, I feel like I'm a professional Uber driver when I'm not when I'm not doing work stuff. I'm driving my kids to sports, and it truly can be very overwhelming. But if you take it one step at a time and you realize the priorities that you have to keep first, the ones that you want to keep,
right.
Of a sudden it makes it really easy. But it is a challenge, and I don't want to, you know, I'm not sugarcoating that for anyone who's getting to that stage or starting to be at the stage. I mean, it can absolutely be a challenge, and it's something that you have to have, you know, supportive friends and a supportive spouse. For me, my wife enables me to do all these things, and I couldn't do any of it without her.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a guy who's solidly mid-career. I'm literally at the 50% mark of my career, and you're obviously at the very beginning of the career. What advice? You've done an amazing job for 5 years then. Amazing. What advice do you have to fellow colleagues who are in your age group, in their 30s, who are looking to get more exposure, be more involved in these things, be a KOL, be participate in clinical trials, travel and teach. What advice you got? Because it's obviously different than when I did it 20 years ago.
Yeah. I think the first thing is be curious. You know, if you want to get involved, ask questions, talk to your reps. I mean, that's really the first thing. Your reps can be the gatekeepers. They know people in their company. If they see you're a good surgeon, if they see you're genuine, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be genuine. You have to truly want to teach and talk because you enjoy it, not because of some ulterior motive, right?
Like, but for the money's gone. It's very different than it was before.
Right.
Before, it was far different.
Yeah. If you're doing it for that reason, it's the wrong reason. You're going to do better in your practice. You're going to do better down in your practice, right? You have to enjoy it and you have to want to teach. And if you want that, you know, there's also a lot of different meetings that you can get involved with, whether it's ASCRS or Academy. I mean, there's ways to get involved in the wet labs and skills labs. And those are great ways to get some exposure if you want to do more teaching in that style. But I think for getting more connected with industry, starting with your reps is a great option. And sharing surgical videos. It takes a lot. Yeah. It takes a lot to put your surgical videos out there because you are going to open yourself up for feedback.
That's a very nice way of putting it. I eat criticism, harsh criticism.
Yes, there will be backseat surgeons who will tell you how you could have done things better and differently. And many times they have great, valid points, you know, and I do learn from that. And sometimes I'm like, I disagree, but okay, you know. But it's all part of the process. And if you're able to put yourself out there and you can put yourself out there with a surgical video and people know you're a good surgeon, then speaking from the podium is actually pretty easy because you're going to get those same questions and that same feedback there. But if you can do it and not feed the trolls, if you will, you know, who just comment stuff that can be inflammatory, then speaking from the podium is very simple.
No, for sure. Have you done any live surgery events yet at these meetings?
You know what? I haven't. I've had.
Well, we got to get you plugged in.
I've offered it. I've offered it. A couple of people. I've done it for. Well, not broadcast anywhere. I've talked about doing it for Orbis and CyberSight. We talked about doing some live MIGS cases. I actually need to follow up with them on that because it is something we had talked about. You know, I think there's absolutely value to it and being able to ask questions and be plugged in. I think CyberSight and Orbis has a great live surgery arm for that. But yeah, I have no problem doing it. I mean, I've certainly had tons of people just kind of come into the OR and, you know, but that's different than when you're being, I at least I imagine that's different than being broadcast and streamed kind of throughout. It's like, all right, everyone is watching.
Yeah, no, it's obviously the pressure's on, but I think it's a great way of learning. It's less common now in U.S. meetings. I've done it for at the ASRS. Mm-hmm. I did it at an Academy meeting. But back then, I mean, to show you how old it is, I did it in my surgery center, Beverly Hills. It was broadcast live via satellite instead of the internet to the Academy meeting, which that year was in Atlanta. And so it's like, obviously, these programs still exist, but they're actually more common overseas. Like I just came back from a meeting in Brazil, the Brazilian mm-hmm. chiropractic meeting. They had four live rooms going on at once.
Wow.
Just a lot of international meetings do it. And so we should certainly get you plugged in. So it's a nice way. It's you're operating under a little bit of pressure. And the tough part is you'll have two earpieces, one in each ear. One is the ophthalmologist in the audience, the moderator asking you questions. And hopefully they're asking you about chopping when you're doing chopping. And they're not asking you about like, IOLs when you're doing shopping. But the other, you also have the director for the video saying, okay, center the eye, focus up, move your hand. Your left hand's blocking my side camera. So it's
nice.
Yeah,
I like that. That sounds and fun.
Throw in a time difference too, and a language barrier, and an unfamiliar OR. You got a recipe for some fun.
I love it. Hey, I'm always up for a challenge. That sounds very interesting.
It was great. Yeah, I had the privilege of doing dozens of them. I've done dozens of them all over the world. It's a fun thing to do. You should definitely get involved in that.
Yeah. Mainly so cataracts.
Go ahead.
Was it mainly cataracts that you were doing or anything?
Yeah, primarily cataracts. You know, if it's company sponsored, they want you to show their new product, their new lens, mm-hmm. their new this, how you're doing it. And sometimes you'll even have, you know, camera on your foot pedal, camera on your hands, a side view, a microscope view. They've got all kind of multiple angles going. A couple other hints too, you know, make sure it's the patient you know, or the patient's second eye, so the patient's not nervous. Make sure they're giving a reasonable amount of anesthesia. When we say in the U.S. topical anesthesia, in other countries they may think, well, here's your bottle of tetracaine, go have fun. And you actually mean like, I don't know, I mean like some IV sedation plus give me the bottle of tetracaine.
Right.
So you got to kind of clear those things ahead of time. But no, I think you do a great job.
Yeah.
But getting back to our topic here, so for young people, so stay curious. Obviously, pursue what you enjoy. But I think I like your last point the most, which is just use social media, put a video out there. I comment on random video, on resident videos all the time that I see.
Yeah, my rep told me, you know, and I had asked him like, hey man, how can I get more involved, you know? And they were able to kind of plug me in with some certain people, but he was like, really, you gotta, you know, have a social media presence. That's what it takes these days. Right. And that's really part of the reason why I got started. And my, you know, my social media wasn't my social media isn't to target potential patients. I'm not out there trying to say, hey, come see me for LASIK. Really, it's just surgical videos, you know, and it's actually terrible media for it's terrible medium for surgical videos. You know, I should have done YouTube from the beginning, and I still don't have a YouTube channel, but none of my stuff's searchable. You know, I've got all this stuff on Instagram and nothing searchable.
Right. Well, plus, since YouTube is owned by Google and Google controls the search engines, the other thing too is Google now, it's a different generation. If I ask my son to, you know, help, you know, go fix the kitchen sink or the sink disposal, I would go to a website and read instructions. He'll YouTube, go to a maybe. Video.
Oh, yeah.
He'll go to a video right away. Yep. And so now YouTube, because of that, has prioritized videos. So if you have videos about topics, that's going to be just really well indexed. Yeah. But whereas whatever you put on Insta or Facebook is not nearly the same level of indexing.
Yeah, it's there. It's in the moment. It's trending, maybe. And then it's gone. And it's out of sight, out of mind, never to be dug up again. Right?
Right.
And so, yeah, at some point, I'm going to go back and maybe, you know, I've got a... So we started a fellowship, or we are launching a fellowship. We just matched our first fellow. So real excited about that.
So tell me about your practice. You're in a very historic, well-established, large practice in Houston. Tell me about it. I don't know much.
Yeah. So I'm at Berkeley Eye Center. So Ralph Berkeley was one of the founders, and I'm one of the partners now, which is very exciting. It's another full circle moment because I grew up in this practice. So my dad was always on the business side of things from late 90s. And so I grew up in this practice. I did mission trips. I was watching cataract surgery when I was in middle school and high school. And during medical school, I was like, I've got to do something other than ophthalmology. You know, I've got neurosurgery or interventional radiology, but it just, I kept getting pulled back to ophthalmology. I loved the innovation, everything else. Anyways, so our practice is now this, we were originally a refractive practice, meaning high volume LASIK. They would do, you know, 60 LASIK cases in the morning and then 30 cataracts in the afternoon.
Wow.
And that's what this practice was. Now it's a large multi-specialty practice. We're huge. We have almost 38 optometrists and 24 surgeons now, I think, with three retina, multiple glaucoma, cornea. You know,
I must have like 20 locations then.
26 locations, three ASCs. It's very large. Yeah. And you know, almost 650 employees. I mean, it's a large organization, and it's so fun. It's so fun to be a part of this now, having grown up in it. It was a lot smaller, obviously, when I was, you know, growing up, but to have been involved and see it grow and now to be a part of it and helping it take the next steps. And so one of those next steps is a fellowship, which we are really excited about starting this year. And
tell me about the fellowship.
Yeah. So it's similar to, you know, we modeled it kind of after all the amazing things that Rob Weinstock and Bill Wiley and Vance Thompson and John Berdahl have done with their fellows. And so the idea is that it's going to be high volume, high exposure, cataract and refractive, you know, everything from ICLs to multifocals to, you know, even some complex cases, glaucoma, if they want to get comfortable putting, you know, doing anterior and vitrectomy through the pars plano, where they can spend some time with our retina folks. So really just allowing you to kind of do everything that we do and be able to hit the ground running with full knowledge of all of this stuff. Cause for me, you know, when I joined, I had to learn everything either myself or one of my partners had to come over and teach me.
But you had great training. You did residency at Emory. That's like an amazing program.
Phenomenal training. So phenomenal cataract training.
Grady Hospital, training. With Grady Hospital, you know how to work.
Absolutely. Yeah. So definitely hit the ground running there. And I was a very competent intraocular surgeon. And I got very comfortable even doing vitrectomy. But the refractive side didn't really get much exposure. You know, we didn't put in any multifocals. We didn't do any refractive surgery. We got to cut some flaps on some pig eyes, one afternoon, but that was really it, you know? And now I do a ton of LASIK and a lot of ICLs, a lot of refractive lensectomies, all these different things. And so it has been kind of a big shift, but still founded on that, you know, that initial, or it's all based on that initial foundation of cataract surgery. I'm really excited because, again, as part of, you know, finding this whole group and being involved in teaching and things, being able to teach a fellow and have really hands-on teaching experience. You know, you were highly involved in teaching for a long time, so you know exactly what I'm talking about.
10,000 resident cases attended.
And I've missed that. Like I missed that teaching and that relationship. And so I'm really, really, really looking forward to it. And we do a lot of research. You know, we just wrapped up one, but I have 15 clinical trials in various phases right now at our practice.
Busy.
And for anyone wanting to get interested, you know, anyone that wants to get involved in research, I think Christos talked a little bit about research in private practice when he was on, but it's absolutely doable. There's a ton of research that's done in private practice, a ton. And so again, talking to your reps, they can plug you in. If you know someone at your practice doing research, if you can get plugged in as a sub-I, that helps build that resume. You know, you're probably not going to get added as a principal investigator on the very first study that you ever do. You have to build up to it. The other thing you can do is investigator initiated studies. And that's something that I've been fortunate enough to have. I think I have 7 different investigator initiated studies, two that have wrapped, one that I just published the paper on, another one that it's been accepted and should come out here in the next week or two. And it's just fun. If you have a clinical question, which like I said, always question kind of what you're doing, you can answer it. You can find someone to help fund your question, your hypothesis. And what's great is they're unrestricted grants. So it doesn't matter what the answer is in terms of whether it may or may not benefit the company that helped funded your study.
Right.
It's an unrestricted grant, but you have a clinical question, you can find a way to fund that. And that's a great way to get involved in research as well and answer some fun questions, get involved getting podium presentations in terms of, you know, presenting abstracts at ASCRS. And so I think that's another just phenomenal way to get involved.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be an amazing fellowship. What's interesting in the refractive world is, first, a quote from Bobby Osher, today's dogma is tomorrow's dog food. Right now, we finally consider cataract surgery to be a very, very powerful refractive surgery. 20 years ago, when I thought of that, I said, you know what? I think cataract's the best way of doing refractive surgery. I was labeled as quasi-crazy. And 20 years before me, Osher set the bar. When he says, hey, I got this high hyperope who's 40 years old and no cataract, I'm going to make that patient pseudophakic. And they thought he was crazy. They crucified him. And today you do that any day of the week. Yep, you wild this 45-year-old suffer with it being a plus 10 hyperope when you've got a solution in your hands.
Yeah.
So yeah, things keep evolving. And the neat part too is I think now probably the best cataract refractive anterior segment fellowships are non-academic, non-university affiliated right now. The ones you mentioned are all amazing. I think yours is going to be fantastic. But it's kind of interesting to see how the tides have kind of shifted. Gone are the days where you say, well, I want to learn how to do refractive surgery, so let me do a cornea fellowship. Right. That didn't make a whole lot of sense because while that may be a slight part of it, it's not everything.
I was scared to do a cornea fellowship. You know, I really did want to do some additional training, and a lot of my mentors encouraged me to do it, but I was a little worried. I knew that I didn't want to do a lot of tissue cases, and I was a little worried that I would come into a practice and they'd say, okay, you get all the DMX and DSEX and PKs.
Right. Better corneal ulcers.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. When I was a resident, a cornea fellowship at UCLA, the cornea fellowship was 2 years, and you'd become an expert at PKPs and corneal ulcers. And I was like, that's just not what I want to do. So I only liked 2 fellowships when I was a senior resident. I liked Dick Lindstrom's fellowship in Minneapolis, and I liked Doug Koch's in at Baylor. And then at the time, Roger Steinert had just come to UC Irvine. And so I liked his as well. Or actually, Peter McDonald was just leaving and Roger Steinert was coming. But then at the time, I also had a young newborn baby. I'm like, you know what? I don't really want to move to Minneapolis or Houston.
Right. Yeah. And I was, unfortunately, I didn't know that private practice fellowships existed. I just didn't
know. Universities don't tell you all this stuff. And then the other thing too is, even for the studies, more studies than not in ophthalmology are done in private practices,
yes,
not universities.
Right. So yeah, a lot of the basic research, a lot of some of the translational, the early stuff is because they have the funding in the labs to do that. But you know, when it's phase two, three, and four studies going on, a lot of times it is just because you need the volume, right? The industries they're trying to get to market with phase two and phase three studies. And so they want to be, you know, out there and in the hands of people who are doing a lot of surgery, because it helps them enroll more quickly. And I think it's something that we all play a role in. I mean, we can't do it without the academics. They play a huge role and vice versa. And I think that's the important thing, is that, you know, if you're in academics and looking to potentially get out, but you're a resident and you're not sure what you want to do, but you want to be involved in research, the main thing, I think the key point here is you can still do it. Regardless of whether you're in academics or private practice, there's still an avenue to do research and answer clinical questions.
Yeah, and pursue your passions. I think you're absolutely right. And I think now with the guy considering the refractive surgery alliance, I think we're moving towards having it refractive surgery encompassing everything, whether you said cataract, corneal refractive, phakic IOLs, incorporating all this into a subspecialty is coming into blossom, coming into bloom now.
I think it's a phenomenal idea, and I think it's something that's necessary. You know, we have uveitis, retina, cornea, glaucoma, peds, plastics, but refractive surgery, really, if you look at the volume of procedures done,
right,
it's the highest volume between refractive and cataract, or refractive cataract, and it's not its own specialty. And it really should be. And I think that the World College of Refractive Surgery and what Guy and Arthur Cummings and who else is involved in that? Chuck Williamson,
people.
All of those people that are really driving that movement, I think it's brilliant. And I think it's absolutely something that is needed and required. And I really hope that we as a group of refractive surgeons really jump in and say, yes, we are a specialty. We are a specialty.
Yeah, no, I think it's coming. It's just, you know, progress takes time, but certainly, yeah. And I think what's coming in the future for us is just going to be even more amazing. We've got things coming like accommodating lenses. We've got true refractive index shaping. I did a podcast with Randy Olson, where he talks about being able to adjust any IOL in perpetuity, even decades later, while it's in your eye. I mean, this is going to be amazing things.
I think refractive indexing, I remember seeing it presented at ASCRS. I was a resident. It was ASCRS. I think it was one of the last years of my residency, and it was presented. And I just remember, I think my jaw hit the floor. I mean, I was just like, this is groundbreaking. I mean, to be able to, okay, we're going to shape a lens, or we're going to, you know, cut a refractive or diffractive pattern into a monofocal lens. Now, okay, now we're going to neutralize a diffractive pattern for a patient who doesn't like the glare and halos. Yeah. No more twisting out necessary. You know, we're just going to neutralize it. I mean, I think it's got phenomenal potential if we can get it there. And then, like you said, accommodative IOLs. I mean, there's so many exciting things, and even robotic surgery. I mean, I think a lot of cataract surgeons.
It's open.
Yeah, I think a lot of cataract surgery, I think it scares a lot of people. And I think it's like anything. I don't think it's something we should be afraid of. I think it's something that we need to learn to embrace, because it doesn't matter. We're high volume surgeons. And even if every ophthalmologist was a higher volume surgeon, we still couldn't actually keep up with the volume required to take care of our aging population.
Right. I mean, we're at a point now where we can accomplish most of what we need to do. But you look at other countries like, in India, all the ophthalmologists can operate to their max potential every day and not sleep and not eat, and you still will not get rid of the backlog.
Exactly. And, so, and yeah. that's that's where it's going to play the role. It's going to be more of like a, not necessarily a stopgap, but it's going to help us catch up and really improve the overall quality of life for so many people who otherwise would be on long wait list or waiting for surgery. Right. And yeah, we can probably utilize it to potentially have better outcomes, you know, here in the United States. We'll see. That's to be seen. But I think it'll happen in my lifetime. I think that by the time I retire, I will be in some way, shape, or form directing, you know, a robot to either assist with a surgery or, you know, potentially even doing it on my behalf.
And maybe sooner than that. I mean, I'm involved with a company now called Horizon Surgical Systems, which has a robotic cataract surgery platform, which is very surprising to me. Yeah, I watched it make an incision, and I was like, it makes the incision just like me. And then they said, yeah, we trained it from your videos.
I love that. I love that. Was it uniplanar? Was it triplanar, biplanar?
Yeah, whatever it was. It was just amazing to see this is happening. And I think you'll get to the point where you'll have one surgeon. The robot can be fantastic for routine type cases, not going to be great for very complicated, unusual cases, but for the 90+% of the routine, you can have one surgeon supervising four robots at once. On a screen, and you can like, okay, you know what, pause that robot, let the other three continue, and you can go take over for one. But I think it'll help us get a lot more throughput. And like you said, bottom line is help a lot more people, and hopefully with a higher level of state safety.
Yep. And I think one of the things that has to develop, and it's getting there, I mean, we're very close, but being able to rapidly develop whole eye models, being able to scan an eye and say, okay, here's a full 3D eye, because the computer has to know, you know, the robot has to know where it is in 3D space.
Sure.
And so it can do live imaging of an eye, but if you can preoperatively generate a 3D model of that eye, then the computer already knows it can plan ahead of time exactly what it's going to do within that model. And And so there's a lot of cool next steps that can happen from that. And there are companies working on that. But the other thing that's amazing to think about is what we're going to be able to see as clinicians when we have these fully developed models. I mean, right now we're excited about 3D OCT and, you know, really fancy high definition ultrasounds and anterior segment OCT, things like that. But imagine to be able to like just have a complete 3D model of the eye. Like, let me zoom in on that macular hole, you know.
Right.
Okay, cool. So let me take a look at that little lattice degeneration there. Is that an atrophic hole? Is there a little bit of subretinal fluid there? Let me zoom in. Oh yeah, I can, you know, I mean, it's going to be just remarkable what we're able to accomplish with just the imaging.
Right. They're off the most working on it right now. Cause you could think about it this way too. If I had to ask your opinion about a patient, you can be in Houston, I can be in LA, and I can show you, here's the anterior segment photos.
Right.
Here's anterior segment imaging. Here's the topography, the tomography. Here's the biometry data. Here's OCT of the optic nerve. Here's OCT of the macula. Here's the wide view of the retina. What else do you need to see?
Yeah, you're right.
I mean, you can pretty much diagnose most things this way. The other thing too that's neat is that by having the pre-op scan of the patient's eye and the 3D model, there's never any wrong patient, wrong site surgery.
Right.
Because when the student patient lies down under the robot scans, they're like, that doesn't match up with the plan. Wait, that's not the right patient. It's not the right, correct eye.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, there's just so many, you know, automated checks and balances that are just built into the system, even the way it is. I mean, it just at the heart of it, right? I mean, that's what's so cool about it.
Yeah, listen, it's an amazing time to be an ophthalmologist. I think the best, most amazing parts of ophthalmology are still to come. I'm kind of bummed that I'm mid-career. I kind of wish I was back at the beginning of my career to have more time in this amazing field.
Well, you don't have, you're still young. You don't have to stop. Go to your 90.
I'm 17 years ahead of you.
You can still go to your 90. There's plenty of surgeons that...
I don't know. There's a balance. You know, I have a friend who's a cardiothoracic surgeon, and he says, the saying they have in cardiothoracic surgery is, a young surgeon is such a cowboy, he'll kill you. Old surgeon is so passive, he's just going to watch you die.
Ooh.
Now, we don't do cardiothoracic surgery,
right?
But it kind of hits on the point, like, there is a balance there somewhere. I mean, there are no NBA players who are 58 years old. Yeah, I don't know if I want to practice. I don't want to do surgery when I'm 90. I think I'd be good if I, you know, knock out another 20 years.
I think I'm right there with you. I'll be happy. I think if I make it, not, I mean, I know I'll make it to 60, but you know, around 60s, I'll start probably looking to phase out and maybe take the next step in the career. Maybe that's, you know, developing something or being involved with developing other things, or I don't know. But I think that that's, I think for me, that's probably going to be a good age. Cause there's just, I love what I do. I love what we do.
We all do. That's the beauty of ophthalmology.
But there's so much more out there too that I also want to explore and see.
Another neat thing I realized in my career was that every 10-ish years, maybe 15 years, it's kind of good to shift gears and change things up a little. Like when I retired last year from teaching residents at age 52, people were like, 52, that's a little too young, isn't it, to retire from teaching residents? And I was like, you know, I'm good. It's time. I did it for 22 years from ages 30 to 52. And then 52 was the youngest I could possibly take the pension. So I was like, okay, I'll take it. See ya. And not that I don't mean to drop the mic and move on, but it's more like pass the baton.
Yeah.
That was a great thing to do when I was in my 30s and maybe 40s, where at a county hospital, anything that walks in the door, you got to handle. So we do cases where a patient comes in with terrible NVG, pressure 60, cornea's cloudy, oh, they got a cataract. In one sitting, we're like, okay, we'll inject them with Avastin down the clinic. We'll take them to the OR this evening. We'll take the cataract out, let the cornea clear it up, put the indirect on, do indirect PRP in the retina. Now put the IOL in, now do the almond valve. Boom, one case, everything done.
10 minutes.
Yeah, not quite. But I mean, but you need someone who's young and able to kind of just, you know what? Hey, let's crank.
Right.
And so I think it's time to, so even for you, I guess, you know, you'll figure out you're in an amazing place now. You should just keep going, pedal the metal. But maybe in 10 years, you'll say, you know what? Let me shift gears a little bit, try something else, get involved in other projects. And I highly encourage you to do that. It keeps it exciting. It really does.
I think that's great advice. And I will, as I have, I will continue to rely on you for advice as my career continues. So
take it all with a grain of salt. Listen, I made plenty of mistakes. Believe me, there's a funny saying. I said this on my previous podcast. A friend said to me, he says, would you take this deal? You get $50, but the person you hate the most gets $100. You take that deal? I'm like, sure. Why wouldn't I want $150? Because I usually hate myself the most. Right? But that just kind of sums it up. I think it's an ophthalmology is an amazing place. Taking my advice with a grain of salt. Obviously, use your own brain. But I also want to change gears one more time, talk about your podcast, which you had me on. I love listening to your podcast. Tell us about that. I'll put a link below. I definitely want my podcast listeners and my Cataract Coach fans to come check out your podcast.
Well, I really appreciate that. You know, it was a project that was born out of, I stumbled upon some old interviews of Ralph Berkeley. Okay. And he passed away at 94, and he was just a phenomenal gentleman and a scholar and teacher. And in these interviews that, you know, at that point he just wasn't answering with the same snap and pizzazz that he once had and the vigor that he once had. And the questions weren't quite what I would have asked if it were me asking the questions.
Sure.
And I started thinking, you know, like we have a lot of incredible ophthalmologists out there who have a story to tell, and there's going to come a point in time when it's too late for them to tell it. And I really want to capture that. And so I started this podcast called The History of Eye Care. And really what it is at least at this point, it's the story or the history of eye care through right now, probably my goal is around 100 ophthalmologists or so, and we'll continue it, but as told by 100 ophthalmologists. So it's not like picking up a textbook and ophthalmology was started, and you know, it's the personal stories and the experiences of all these different ophthalmologists and people in industry, because as much impact as all of these ophthalmologists have had on our field, there are so many industry people, the engineers, the people who have just driven innovation in these companies who have an equally important role. And so trying to get all of that captured so that the younger ophthalmologists can listen at any point. It may be 10 years from now, maybe 15 years from now. You know, and what I often say is to the guest is pretend that it's your great, 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 great grandson or granddaughter. and they want to hear your story and what, you know, they're going into ophthalmology and they want to hear your story, you know, and kind of frame it that way. And so it's been a fun project. It really has. It's been a fun project. It's been like everything else that I seem to do. It ends up being a lot more work than I initially thought it was going to be.
But it all is.
But it's been very rewarding. It's been very fun. And I've learned so much. I mean, right. I've learned so much.
Yeah, my favorite episode you did so far was Howard Gimbel. Wow, what an amazing man. Such a humble, kind, amazing man who has like 10 times my IQ.
I'm 20 times mine. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, the things that he came up with from, you know, and he just very nonchalant. He's like, oh yeah, I came up with that. I came up with that. And, you know, it's like the capsulorexis and divide and conquer. And even I mean, I remember I had a case and I'm trying to think of how this actually happened. I saw the article in JCRS. It was like 2018 or 2019 in JCRS, and it was about posterior haptic tuck. Okay. And even posterior haptic tuck was Howard Gimbel. And I had a case later on, and I was able to you know, posterior capsule had a tear and was able to fixate with anterior capture and the haptics in the bag, a toric lens. And it was all because of that article. And that was also Howard Gimbel. It's like unbelievable the things that he has come up with over his career. It's just, it's fascinating. You're absolutely right. He's so incredibly humble. And I had just a blast talking to him.
Yeah, it was a fantastic. You're a great interviewer. That was a fantastic podcast. I listened to it twice.
Oh, thank you.
I want to make sure I didn't miss anything good there. But yeah, that's the other side of the coin there too. Is remember in ophthalmology, there's so many ridiculously amazing people that please never compare yourself to others. Only compete with yourself because boy, comparison is the thief of joy. If I look at my podcast guests, I'm like, I am such a nothing in comparison.
Yeah. And actually, I think that's such a great point, and it builds on what you said when you said you were your own, you know, the person you hate the most is yourself. I think that's important.
Critic.
Yeah. Right. I think that's exactly how it should be. And you're so right. And that's something that it took me a while to learn that too, especially starting out being a resident. Why, you know, why'd so-and-so get to do that case and not me? Why did, you know, they got to do more cases than me, blah, blah, blah. Just get over it. Get over it. Life is way too short. You're going to do great, amazing things, but be competitive with yourself. It doesn't matter how competitive you are. It, you know, and you may have played sports at the highest level, but you need to, as you get into surgery, everyone else out there is on your team. You know, they're not the competition. They're your team. Doesn't matter if they're at the practice next door or the practice across the country, we're all on the same team, and that's to help patients. And so if you want to compete with someone, I think you're absolutely right. Compete with yourself.
Ah, such great advice. Let's end it with that, because that's probably the best take-home message here. I have loved talking to you. I really admired from the sidelines the rapid ascent of your career and your public persona, your KOL status, if you will. And the reason I like it, I love it so much, is that I think you're super brilliant. You're very innovative. And you really have just a joy of teaching and sharing knowledge. And I think that says a lot.
Well, thank you. I had some incredible mentors and still have incredible mentors, and I lean on them for pretty much everything. And so wouldn't have been able to do it all without them, including yourself.
And with that said, I'm going to bug you for, we're going to have your podcast. And then the day after, I'm going to feature a surgical video from you. So you got to send me a good video.
All right. I'll send you a good video.
Really good. So if you listen to the podcast on the day it's released, the very next day is going to be the video from Morgan. It'll be something amazing.
Sounds good.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank my viewers and my listeners for tuning in again this week. What an amazing podcast. We have a new podcast, as you know now, every single week on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Google, wherever you find podcasts, of course on YouTube, of course on cataractcoach.com as well. And we will catch you next time.
Thank you for enjoying that podcast with me. I want to remind you to check out all our other social media platforms, including the YouTube videos, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, and of course the website cataractcoach.com, where we have a free PDF book, a 25-part curriculum series, and so much more. I promise you'll find it very much worth your while. And I also want to thank Harrow Incorporated for sponsoring this podcast.